So let's see. Let me begin with sort of a couple of disclaimers. So this is actually, in some sense, two talks in one. One is about numerical methods for simulating general relativity, and the other is about a long-standing project begun about a decade ago by Beverly Berger and Vince Moncrief to use numerics to understand how singularities work. So that's sort of the first disclaimer. I'll be kind of switching back and forth between what seem like two somewhat disconnected topics. And then the second disclaimer is that this is, to a certain extent, work in progress. So some of it has been published in PhysRev and appears on GRQC here. And some of what I'll be talking about is sort of what we're going to do next. Okay, so here's the plan of the talk. I'm going to tell you about something that's actually a very old idea mathematically, but for some reason hasn't seen a lot of use as a numerical method. That's the use of harmonic coordinates. Then I'll tell you a little bit about the question of how general relativity behaves near singularities. And then I'll say a little bit about how we've used this method to say something about this subject. And then I'll say a little bit about other things that the method could be used for. And then I'll conclude and talk about future projects. Okay, so let me start with sort of a capsule summary of what one does when one does numerical simulations of relativity and what some of the sort of pitfalls and difficulties are. So in numerical simulations, you're basically given some physical system, usually described by some differential equation, and now you want to turn that differential equation into something that can be done on the computer. So typically, what one does is to replace these nice smooth continuous functions by their values on a bunch of lattice points. Then you replace the differential operators with difference operators, essentially just taking differences on nearby lattice points instead of derivatives. And then that turns the differential equations into finite difference equations. You put those finite difference equations on the computer and you march along and see what the results are. So this is certainly something that people do in all sorts of fields of physics. And then the question is, why can't we just go ahead and take over the methods that people have used in, say, fluid dynamics and just apply them to general relativity and crank out the answer? And the reason is that it turns out that there are a bunch of difficulties that numerical relativity has that other numerical simulations in other fields of physics don't seem to have. So one difficulty is numerical instability. I mean, roughly speaking, these finite difference operators are supposed to be good approximations to the differential operators, but you're not guaranteed for a particular way of writing a differential equation as a finite difference equation that in the limit that you take lattice spacing to zero, the solution of your difference equation will converge to anything at all. Maybe it'll blow up. Such blow-ups are called numerical instabilities, and in fact, often one has to work very hard to come up with a numerical method that doesn't have numerical instabilities. And in fact, these numerical instabilities plague a lot of what's going on in general relativity. In something like fluid dynamics, I mean, there's a fairly straightforward way of writing out what the equations are. But in general relativity, partly because of the diffeomorphism invariants, there's an enormous number of different ways that one could think of writing the equations. And some of them have sort of nicer mathematical or numerical properties than others. So this question of what one should use for the form of the equations is also an issue in numerical relativity. Another difference between general relativity and other fields of physics is that we have actual real curvature singularities. Things blow up in a finite amount of time, and then the question is, how do you deal with that? There are also the possibility of coordinate singularities. Maybe the space-time that you're simulating is you know, fine, but you've made a bad choice of coordinates, and so your code blows up because of that. There's the question of what to do at the outer boundary. I'll say a little bit more about this later. And then there's also the fact that general relativity is in some sense a constrained system. Usually one thinks of the variables as being, say, the spatial metric and the extrinsic curvature, but those can't be freely specified. They have to satisfy some set of constraints. And then the question is, how well are those constraints preserved as you do the evolution? And then finally, in general relativity, we have black holes, and simulating those also provides a challenge. So what I'm going to talk about today is in part a method that I think can go a long way to solving some of these difficulties, and that's what I'll be presenting next. Okay, so what I'm going to tell you about on this transparency is something that's actually been known for over half a century now as a mathematical method, but which hasn't seen particularly much use as a numerical method. And I'll explain why I think it's helpful to do this sort of thing in general relativity, and also I'll explain why, to a certain extent, people haven't done very much of this before. So the idea is the following. Because general relativity has invariance under coordinate transformations, if you just say, I'm going to write down Einstein's equation in some particular coordinate system, you don't get an equation that has a well-defined evolution, because you have to somehow fix that extra freedom. This should be familiar to you from thinking about Maxwell's equations. Suppose that we have Maxwell's equations, and we say we're going to write them as an equation for the vector potential. Well, if you just say, I'm going to write down Maxwell's equations for the vector potential, then in fact, that's a very bad system of equations. And the reason is that for the vector potential, you have the freedom to add the gradient of a scalar field to it. And so if I just write down Maxwell's equations for a vector potential and then say I'm going to evolve this, you find that the evolution is not in fact determined by the initial data. Well, we all know an easy way to fix that, though. In the case of Maxwell's equations, you pick some convenient gauge, say Lorentz gauge. When you do that, Maxwell's equations for the vector potential look a lot like the wave equation. We all know how to evolve the wave equation and everything is fine. A similar thing happens in general relativity. In general relativity, what you want to do is to pick some coordinate condition, like the gauge condition on the vector potential, that will turn general relativity into a well-defined set of evolution equations for the metric. Such a thing is in fact known, and it uses something called harmonic coordinates. So in harmonic coordinates, you assume that your coordinates are each solutions of the wave equation. I'm going to tell you something that's a little bit different. Instead of assuming that the coordinates are solutions of the wave equation, let's assume solutions of the wave equation with a particular source, where the source is just given from the beginning. Okay, so what does this do for you? What this does is it turns the Ricci tensor into an expression that looks like wave operator acting on metric, plus a bunch of stuff that depends only on the metric and its first derivatives, plus some stuff that depends on this source term H. So this has been known for over 50 years, and in fact, it was just this trick that was first used to put Einstein's equation in a nice form so that one could prove local existence of solutions.
Is H given over the whole
spacetime? Yes, over the whole spacetime.
And is it given as a function of the metric?
It's given as a function of the coordinates. Yeah. So the equations in this form have nice mathematical properties, but they also have nice numerical properties. We have a lot of experience in doing numerical simulations of the wave equation. All sorts of nice simple numerical methods work well on the wave equation, and so they ought to work well on Einstein's equation in this form. So that's the basic idea. Okay, so how come people haven't been doing this all along? Why do they, you know, bother with things like the ADM equation when this is so much simpler? The answer is that there is a difficulty associated associated with doing things this way. And let me tell you what that difficulty is, and let me tell you why these source terms might help with the difficulty. So the idea is the following. We're choosing a particular coordinate system to do this. And remember that earlier I said one of the problems that you can run into in general relativity is coordinate singularities. That is, maybe the space-time is perfectly good, but the coordinates go bad. Okay, so how can coordinates go bad? Well, it turns out that there are at least three ways that I can think of. One is the coordinates themselves could cease to be smooth functions. That, it turns out, is not a problem here because the coordinates are solutions of the wave equation. As long as the space-time is smooth, so are the solutions of the wave equation. Another way that coordinates can go bad is that their gradients could cease to be linearly independent. So the idea is that when you have a coordinate system, the coordinates not only have to be smooth, but you can't have any two of them pointing in the same direction. You need something that spans the whole space. And so that could certainly happen with coordinates that satisfy this. And another one, maybe a little bit more subtle, is when you do an evolution of this form, you need your time coordinate to be time-like. That is, you need the surfaces of constant time to be space-like surfaces. And even if you have a solution of the wave equation, even if you started off time-like, it can go null. After a while, it can cease to have a time-like gradient. And that can also happen in this case. So that's essentially the reason for the source terms. Without the source terms, there's sort of very little freedom in this choice of coordinate system, only the choice of sort of initial data for the wave equation here. With this source term, if you start a simulation, say, with zero source, and you find out that the coordinates go bad, then by choosing an appropriate source on the right-hand side, maybe you can postpone or eliminate that place where the coordinates go bad. So using these sources gives you a little bit more freedom and makes this method a little bit more robust. Okay, so I said we know lots of numerical methods for solving the wave equation and that things are nice and simple. Now let me be a little bit more specific about the numerical methods that I actually use. So it turns out that it's convenient when doing numerical evolutions to have a system which is first order in time. So all the variables were only taking one time derivative. And as we all learn in differential equations, the easiest way to do that is to just take the time derivatives of all your variables and make a separate variable out of them. And then an equation that started out second order in time now becomes first order in time. So in addition to the metric g mu nu, let's define another set of variables p mu nu, which are the time derivatives of those metrics. Two variables can't be completely freely specified because due to the use of harmonic coordinates, the Christoffel symbols have to satisfy this. And so in particular, we have to satisfy this on the initial slice and satisfy its time derivative on the initial slice, and then the evolution will preserve this. Okay, so what do we do for spatial derivatives? So we define the variables on a lattice of points. And now if I want to know the first derivative of some function at point I take the difference between the I plus 1 and the I minus 1 point and divide by 2 delta x. And similarly for the second derivative, I form this combination. Gary?
So is that constraint that you wrote down include the usual constraints? I mean, the Hamiltonian momentum constraints in this sort of ADM approach?
Well, you have to satisfy those at the beginning also. I mean, roughly speaking, there are sort of more constraints because there are more variables in addition to the sort of spatial component of the metric and its time derivative. We also have the space. We also have the time, time, and time, space components of the metric. So there are more constraints.
And that constraint, I mean, there are derivatives in the Christoffel symbol.
Right.
Those get lattice sized.
Yes.
And that doesn't cause any particular problem?
Well, so the fact that you're latticizing them means that you don't perfectly satisfy the constraint at the beginning. And so what that means is that you have a sort of non-zero constraint that goes like latticized to some power, and then the idea is if you want it to be small enough, you just need a small enough latticize.
But if it's true to some approximation at the beginning, does it remain true to the same approximation?
You always have to worry about these things getting worse. And this is true not just for this constraint, but for
finite difference equations. It says that if this is true at time zero, then it's all.
No. I mean that would be great. But even if there were such an identity, that wouldn't necessarily help you because you would solve this not exactly, but only in the sort of finite difference version. Yeah, I mean, there are, I guess, you know, for certain simple systems. So suppose you have some system where, say, in the continuum theory, energy is conserved. You might want to come up with, you know, some numerical method that exactly conserves the finite difference version of the energy. And there are sort of some numerical methods of that form for energy for certain systems, but. In this case, this is a constraint, and in the continuum equations, if it were exactly true at the beginning, the evolution equations would preserve it. It's not exactly true at the beginning because you're finite differencing things, and the evolution equations don't exactly preserve it anyway because you're finite differencing them too, and you just hope that things don't get too big too fast. But this is true also for the Hamiltonian and momentum constraints of general relativity. And there, again, you haven't got a hope of keeping the constraints exactly zero. You just hope that they don't get too big too fast.
So where does this constraint come from? I mean, if I pick Gij on the surface, on the surface, and I satisfy the Hamiltonian momentum constraints, mm-hmm. Where does this extra one come from?
So this extra one is basically, so let's suppose that you pick Gij and the extrinsic curvature, okay? Probably the sort of easiest way to say this is something that's sort of in the middle of chapter 10 in Bob Wald's book. Suppose that I have a solution of the plain old ordinary constraints for say Gij and Kij, and now I want to produce from that good initial data for evolution in harmonic coordinates. So I need to add the G00 and G0i and their time derivatives in order to evolve things this way. And so what am I supposed to do? And so what it turns out that what you're supposed to do is you can always set G00 equal to 1 and G0i equal to 0 on the initial data surface, and then you solve these equations for the time derivatives of G00 and G0i. So that's sort of why there's an extra constraint. You're sort of adding extra variables. Yeah, okay. So this is how you do spatial derivatives. Time derivatives are maybe a little bit more complicated, but there's a sort of straightforward method that works quite nicely. This is something called the iterative Crank-Nicholson method. So suppose I have a differential equation of the form time derivative of S is equal to W. Let me implement it in this way. So I'm given S at the nth time step. I want to produce S at the n plus 1 time step. So the difference between these two divided by delta t is basically the time derivative of S, that is W, but evaluated halfway in between the nth time step and the n plus 1 time step. So let me write that equation as this. S at n plus 1 is S at n plus delta t times the average of W at n and W at n plus 1. So at first sight, this equation looks completely useless because here you're supposed to figure out S at the n plus 1 time step, but in order to use this formula, you need to already know S at the n plus 1 time step. And so what are we supposed to do with this? So the answer is that in simple cases, like the wave equation, you can actually explicitly solve this equation for Sn plus 1, and then you have something which is called the Crank-Nicolson method. For more complicated things like Einstein's equation, you haven't really got a hope of solving this, but you can do something that's almost as good. Take an initial guess for Sn plus 1, say Sn, so your initial guess is gee, things don't evolve at all. Plug that initial guess into the right-hand side to generate a better guess on the left-hand side. Plug that better guess in to generate an even better guess, and then keep going either until convergence or for some, you know, small number of time steps. So in particular, in a sort of standard way of doing which I use, you just iterate this thing three times, and then you've produced a good guess for what S is at the next time step. So in principle, then, coding is pretty simple. You just take Einstein's equation, where the variables are metric and its time derivative, write that equation as time derivative of variables is equal to function of variables, however complicated that is. Anytime you see spatial derivatives, implement them this way and evolve in time doing this. And so that really is all there is to it. Yeah.
In the case of spatial derivative, you have more than one dimension. Is there any spatial thing you need to do? Or?
So if you're in more than one dimension, then you'll have, say, mixed second spatial derivatives. And so that's still a formula that sort of looks like this, only a little bit more complicated. Let's see. I mean, the basic idea for all these formulas is you imagine expanding everything as a Taylor series around the particular point where you are, and then using that Taylor series, write the values of all the nearest neighbors, and then take the particular combination of nearest neighbors that picks off the piece in the Taylor series that's what you want. So suppose you have, say, two dimensions, and now you want second derivative of f with respect to x and y. Then by writing down the Taylor series, you can come up with a formula sort of a little bit more complicated than this that has the appropriate form. And I can show that to you, probably after the talk, just so it doesn't take too much time. But yeah, there's a sort of simple analog of this formula that works for mixed second spatial derivatives. Okay, so let's see. Let me go on then. So now let me switch gears and say a little bit about singularities in general relativity. Okay, so what do we know about singularities in general relativity? Well, we know a sort of very strange combination of things. On the one hand, we have certain solutions like the Schwarzschild solution, the Kerr solution, Robertson-Walker solutions, things where we have exact solutions in closed form, but where the situation has very high symmetry. And so we can study singularities in these closed form solutions that have lots of symmetry. So if that were all we had, then you might think, well, gee, maybe these singularities in general relativity are just an artifact of the symmetry. If you have spherical symmetry, you can sort of focus everything at the center, and so it's not surprising that it all piles up at the center. If you don't have spherical symmetry, gee, maybe something different happens. It turns out, though, that in fact we know that it's not the case that something different happens, and we know that because of a class of results called the singularity theorems. So these singularity theorems basically tell us that as long as gravity is attractive and as long as we don't have funny behavior in terms of closed time-like curves, then certain extreme situations like a closed universe or like the existence of a trapped surface will give rise to a singularity. The frustrating thing about the singularity theorems is that they tell us almost nothing about the nature of the singularity. All the singularity theorems tell us is that under this set of circumstances, some observer will end in some finite amount of proper time. They don't say why the observer ends. They don't tell us whether any curvature blows up along that observer. They don't tell us what's happening to any other observer. And so all the details that we would like to know are basically absent from this.
How can it end if the curvature doesn't blow up?
Well, in all sorts of ways. I'll let Gary give you 10 counterexamples, but I mean, the simplest way is just to take a point. And then you can take a point out. But there are even, you know, sort of silly examples where you have, you know, compact space-times where, you know, everything is smooth everywhere and you can still generate a geodesic that's incomplete. So there are all sorts of you know, ridiculous things where you know, you have some. I mean, you know, we don't think that any of those has any physical relevance whatsoever. But that's sort of the frustrating point of this business. I mean, we're given very little information, and on sort of physics grounds, we expect that we know something about what's happening. But these results don't tell us anything, except that, you know, something nasty is going on somewhere. So I mean, you know, so somebody told you, you know, something catastrophic is going on somewhere, you might want to know, well, what and where and how and why. And the singularity theorems don't tell you any of that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a lot like that, right? I mean, the level of ignorance is comparable. I wish I had thought of that. I'm going to steal that and use it in a subsequent talk. So this is sort of where things stood for a while. One attitude that you might take to this is, well, you know, Einstein's equations are kind of complicated. Maybe the singularities they give rise to are really complicated, and this business is just hopeless. But on the other hand, we know that in the case of some differential equations, that things actually get simpler when you go towards a singularity. For example, in, say, ordinary differential equations, one of the first things that we learn is Bessel's equation. And so in Bessel's equation, the general behavior of the solution is something that you have to sort of work out in some complicated way. But the equation has some singular point, and at that singular point, certain terms in the equations are blowing up. Other terms are negligible by comparison, and so the Bessel functions are actually simpler near their singular points than they are in general. And so the question is, do Einstein's equations have that property? That is, do they have the property that as you get near the singularity, certain terms in the equation become negligible, and the whole behavior of the metric as the singularity is approached is actually simpler than the general behavior of the metric? And if so, how does it simplify? So again, if you just put the question that way, you know, you sort of look at the equation, it's not clear which terms might become negligible and which terms might not become negligible. It's not clear what to do. And that, too, is where things stood for a while until about a decade ago when Beverly Berger and Vince Moncrief decided, well, why don't we do numerical simulations and see what the numerics tell us about what happens as you go towards the singularity. So although numerical simulations don't, in principle, have to have any symmetry in them, in practice, it's much easier to do things in case of symmetry than without, because if you have symmetry, you can ignore some of the coordinates, you can do a much smaller simulation, and so on. And so the first simulations that they did involved a certain amount of symmetry, usually two spatial symmetry directions. Now they later did stuff with only one symmetry direction, and today I'm going to tell you about things that have no symmetry directions at all. So this last part with no symmetry directions at all is sort of work in progress. But what's been done so far leads to a picture that space-time singularities are in some sense space-like, local, and in the vacuum case oscillatory, and in the case of a scalar field, non-oscillatory. Where here, space-like basically means that they look the way they do in Schwarzschild and in Robertson-Walker. Everybody hits the singularity, curvature blows up along those guys that hit the singularity. Local means that in some sense, in the differential equations, as the singularities approach, the time derivatives are a lot more important than the spatial derivatives. And so the dynamics at each spatial point looks a lot like it does in a homogeneous universe. And I'll talk a little bit later about the difference between oscillatory and non-oscillatory.
Demonstration.
Yes, he does, and I'll talk about that a little bit later too. Yeah, there's actually a big result due to Alan Rendell and Lars Anderson on that. Okay, so as a warm-up, let's consider how things look in the case where we have two spatial symmetries. So here we have a metric called collectively the Gaudi spacetimes. We're coming up with metric functions, P and Q, that depend only on the time coordinate and on one of the spatial coordinates, which I'll call X. This set of coordinates, by the way, which people have used for a while for Gaudi spacetimes, also turn out to be harmonic coordinates, which will make it nice and simple to compare with the numerical method I'll talk about later. Okay, so suppose that you say I'm dealing with a metric of this form, where P and Q and this other metric function lambda depend only on the time coordinate T and the space coordinate X. Then for a metric of this form, the vacuum Einstein equations become some set of differential equations, and that set of differential equations is the following. So there's this sort of wave-like equation for P, another one for Q, and it turns out that once you solve those, you can then solve using quadratures for the remaining metric function lambda. So this should actually look familiar to those of you who have looked at stationary axisymmetric spacetimes. It's essentially the same kind of thing. In the stationary axisymmetric case, using these Weyl-type methods, you come up with a pair of elliptic equations, and once you solve those, then the remaining metric component can be gotten by quadratures. So now let's take a look at this. Given the way these coordinates work, the singularity is approached as this time coordinate goes to plus infinity. So this time coordinate, then I want to emphasize, is not proper time. It's a special coordinate chosen so that properties of the singularity are given asymptotically as t goes to infinity. So now let's look at these equations and ask ourselves, what do we expect to happen as t goes to infinity? So the first thing to notice is that all the spatial derivatives have an e to the minus 2t in front of them. So you might guess to yourself, hey, wait a minute. As t goes to infinity, e to the minus 2t is really small. Let me just neglect all these terms with an e to the minus 2t in front of them, and then I get a bunch of equations that, since they don't have spatial derivatives in them, are really ordinary differential equations. And in fact, they're ordinary differential equations you can solve in closed form. So now you have a guess for how things behave as you approach the singularity. So as you approach the singularity, things behave in such a way that at each spatial point, we have a solution of what's called the velocity term dominated equations, the ones where you get to neglect the spatial derivatives in this equation. Okay, so now you might worry about that guess, and let me tell you why you should worry. Okay, so here's why you should worry. So if we get to neglect the spatial derivatives, then the result is that we get a P that grows linearly with T. But this term not only has an e to the minus 2T in front of it, it also has an e to the 2P. So if P is growing linearly at a rate that's less than T, then we're okay. The terms that we neglected really are negligible. If P is growing linearly at a rate faster than T, then we're not okay. This thing that we neglected is in fact not negligible. And so our original guess about how things would happen as we go to the singularity becomes problematic. We now have sort of a reason to believe that, well, maybe that guess isn't right. So once again, the answer is that instead of sort of guessing what's negligible and what isn't, you do numerical simulations. And then from the numerical simulations, you can figure out what's going on. So the numerical simulations that Beverly Berger and Vince Moncrief did showed that, in fact, you do get into this velocity term dominated regime. That is, you do get the case where V grows slower than 1 and where all the spatial derivatives become negligible. Except that there are isolated points where V actually grows faster than 1. And in hindsight, after the numerical simulations, we can sort of see the reason for that. And let me show you what the reason is. So it turns out that the reason for this funny behavior is that if we originally start out in a place where where P is growing faster than 1, this term in the equations will actually knock it down until it's growing slower than 1, except if we're at an isolated point where Q has a maximum or minimum, this term is absent, and then V will continue to grow faster than 1. So we get what's essentially fairly simple behavior, but it's simple behavior where there are some exceptional points. And so this is sort of very bad news for people who want to prove mathematical results, because things that behave like P is growing everywhere slower than 1 except at this one isolated point are very bad mathematically. They don't fit in some nice Sobolev spaces, and so it's very hard for mathematicians to prove theorems about that. And so that's sort of one of the reasons why it's hard to make progress in showing how solutions of Einstein's equation behave. Yeah, it is at 1 point. Well, it's a single spatial point. So the idea, let's see. So what happens is, right, so at this time, you get, something like this, and then at a later time, you get, something that looks like this. So here is sort of the isolated point. Right, so at any finite time, the solution is continuous. It's just that it gets steeper and steeper as time goes along. Right, yeah, it's like a delta function.
The logic seems a little strange to me. So you start off saying that, given e to the minus 2t, spatial derivatives seem to be going away. If you completely ignore them, you find t goes linearly with t.
Right.
Then you said, well, but, there's an e to the p in front, and because of that, q dot here, Q comma X term, we can't ignore it. And now you say that, well, if it's present, it just knocks P to grow slower anyway.
Right.
So whenever it's really there, it's not a problem. It's when it's zero that we really have a problem.
Right, that's right.
So if it's zero, why doesn't your original argument just work and say that, we don't have a problem and we just solve the sort of equations, the local equations?
Because, let's see, there's sort of other terms around in the equation too, right? So there's sort of this term and then there's this term. So let's see. Yeah.
Well, if it's really spiking up like that, PXX is
Right. That's actually true, and that's a fairly subtle point. So it turns out that if it's spiking up and the value at the spike is greater than 1 but less than 2, then you can show a sort of approximation to these equations that still says that this term is negligible. If it's growing faster than 2, that becomes harder. And Marshall Weaver and I are doing numerical simulations of that situation right now to try to resolve that issue. Okay, so let's go on. Okay, so in addition to, sort of all this numerical stuff, plus this sort of heuristic analysis of which terms in the equation are big and which are small, there's also some mathematical results on these things. So in particular, there are results due to these three guys having to do with the behavior of Gaudi spacetimes, for which P and Q start out sufficiently close to zero. There's also a sort of sneaky method due to Rendell and Kitchen-Asami, where what you do is instead of trying to get global results, you look in the neighborhood of the singularity. So you start out at the singularity as though it were a Cauchy surface. You guess what the singular behavior is, you subtract that off, and then you're left with something that you hope is smooth, and you prove a local existence result for that. So then you get sort of local near the singularity results due to these guys. Although again, because of the fact that, this stuff with spikes is not in Sobolev spaces, these guys can essentially prove local existence for the non-spiky things. Although they have a very sneaky trick that also allows them to get local existence for the spiky stuff, but I don't have time to go into that right now. Okay, so that's how things stand if there are two spatial symmetries. What about the case of only one spatial symmetry or the case of no symmetry at all? So for the case with one spatial symmetry, there are these simulations due to Berger and Moncrief, and again they find this approach to the singularity that has this fairly simple form, but instead of just asymptotically approaching something, it looks more like a mixmaster spacetime at each point. You get these directions of expansion and contraction that change in an oscillatory way. So what about no symmetry? So there's this result that Jim talked about earlier due to Rendell and Anderson. And again, this is this sort of sneaky do things in the neighborhood of a singularity, so you're only proving a local existence result. So in this case, they look at not the vacuum Einstein equations, but the Einstein equation with scalar matter, and they make a guess as to what the singular piece is and subtract it off, and they prove a result local in the neighborhood of the singularity for solutions of Einstein's equation with no symmetry at all. Okay, so what happens sort of in the general case? So in the general case, although we don't have theorems about how things go on, we do have the possibility of doing these numerical simulations. And so in particular, the harmonic coordinate method that I talked about earlier is something that's quite good for doing these simulations near the singularity. So where things stand is that I've used this method to do simulations for the Einstein scalar case, where the asymptotic behavior is fairly simple, and where in fact, due to this local mathematical result, we have a very good idea of how things should behave near the singularity. For the vacuum case, where things are likely to be more complicated, this is sort of ongoing work that I'm doing in collaboration with Mark Miller and Beverly Berger and Comer Duncan, and that I'll hopefully be able to say something about at some other time. Yeah, Gary?
Are there analogs of the spikes in these more general cases?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so I guess I'm not understanding. So, for example, in the let's do this Einstein scalar case.
Yeah.
So you have local Kasner behavior at each point. Do the exponents vary continuously from point to point?
Yes.
Okay, so there's nothing that would be a spike.
Right. In the scalar field case,
scalar
right.
Case.
Yeah, there are spikes.
Then you have local mixmaster behavior where, again, things are independent at different points, but I guess they balance at different times. And
right. That's right. And so after a while, things become extraordinarily spiky. Right. Right. Although, I mean, they don't take their simulations to that long a time. If you took it, to an arbitrarily long time, you'd get a real mess.
Did go beyond a paltry four dimensions?
Well, I mean, So, in terms of sort of the number of dimensions in your numerical simulations, this stuff is probably the state of the art. But on the other hand, if you want to be in any, sort of higher number of dimensions but have lots of symmetry, so the problem is smaller, then I think it's about the same. So I think, I'm trying to remember, there are sort of analogs of this Rendell and Anderson result due to Mark Hanno and Marsha Weaver. And there I know they consider a whole bunch of different types of matter, some of which come from string theory. And I believe they also consider other numbers of dimensions. Yeah, I think it probably would be.
There's some papers by Thibaut Amor where he specifically looks at this. They're not numerical, but they're he looks at this mixed master behavior in higher dimensions.
With dilatons,
with these various fluxes, the various forms, and all of that.
But the dilatons in four dimensions tend to iron out the mixed master.
Well, he finds an interesting result, which is that the behavior changes in 10 or 11 dimensions.
No.
Oh, that is interesting. I didn't know about that. You'll have to give me a reference to that one. Okay, so let me go ahead and go on with this. So let me say a little bit about sort of code tests of this code, and I'll show you a couple of results and then say what else this stuff might be good for. So anytime you write a code, just like anytime you do a calculation, you have to convince yourself that you can trust the thing. And so in particular, one of the things you can do is to compare a code to a known solution, either known analytically or known from some other simulation. And then another thing is that you can ask yourself whether, in fact, as the lattice spacing goes to zero, this thing is converging to a solution of the differential equation. And here, the fact that there are constraints actually help you out, because since you don't satisfy the constraints perfectly because of the finite lattice size, as you take the lattice size smaller and smaller, the constraint should get smaller and smaller, and so you can check that. Okay, so let me go ahead and show you a couple of those. So here's the fully three-dimensional code compared to a plain old one-dimensional code evolving the Gaudi equations. So here the line is the results of the one-dimensional code, and then the dots are the results of the three-dimensional code using the same initial data, and they lie on top of each other. So in this case, at least, we get the right answer. Here is a convergence test involving the constraint. So here we run with some lattice spacing, and we see how the constraint depends on time, and we find that it starts off very small, but it does get bigger. Now we'll cut down the lattice spacing by a factor of 2, and then since this is what's called a second order method, the constraint should go down by a factor of 4. So let's take the constraint in the new lattice spacing and multiply it by 4, then they should more or less lie on top of each other, and to within the accuracy of this method, they do. So this is, this is the harmonic coordinate constraint. Right, I mean, you can do, we've done sort of the same thing with the Hamiltonian constraint and the momentum constraint, and they do this too, but this is a particular one. Okay, so now let me show you a result about the approach to the singularity. So the sort of local Kasner behavior that one would expect from this Rendell and Anderson result means that as you approach the singularity, the metric component should go to zero exponentially, and the scalar field should increase linearly. And so here's the result of a simulation. We start out here, we evolve for a while, and sure enough, the scalar field is growing linearly, and the logs of the metric components are growing linearly as well. So these metric components are going down exponentially, as we would expect that they should. So now we're in the process of running these simulations with vacuum instead of the scalar field, where we expect things to be more complicated, and we will hopefully have some results to show on that fairly soon.
So that's for just sitting at one point.
Yeah, that's at one point. So if you go to a different point, you get the same kind of graph but with different slopes. Yeah, exactly.
But with no symmetry with scalar
field. Scalar field and no symmetry, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so let me now switch gears a little bit and say something about what this method can be used for in the sort of larger numerical relativity community. So in the larger numerical relativity community, the interest is not so much in the properties of singularities, but in colliding two black holes. And so the first thing that you might want to know is, how do these things work when you take them out of the periodic boundary conditions of the closed universe and put in some kind of outgoing wave boundary conditions, which are appropriate for asymptotically flat spacetimes? And the idea is that you might expect that they would work very well, because these things make Einstein's equation look like the wave equation. For the wave equation, we know what to do numerically. At the outer grid boundary, we just say, OK, we have some waves, and we impose that those waves be purely outgoing.
I thought you were going to have something. What did it have to do with all the harmonic coordinates and the choice of H? I thought you were going to say, choosing H really probably.
Oh, yeah, okay. So let me, right. So that actually is sort of work in progress. I mean, so it turns out that for the singularity, the coordinates work fine even with zero H. And so all of the simulations I've shown you have no source terms at all. For the asymptotically flat case, it turns out that you need an H, but figuring out sort of which H you need to use the job is sort of still work in progress.
Oh, so you think it's not just the scalar field, which is sort of making the coordinates okay? You think in the vacuum case, the coordinates will be just fine?
Yeah, so for example, in Gaudi spacetimes, those coordinates are fine up to the singularity and their harmonic coordinates. So I expect that things will be fine in the vacuum case too. And in fact, in the simulations we've done so far, the vacuum case, things seem to be fine. So yeah, it does seem to be the difference between the closed cosmology case and the asymptotically flat case. Okay, so let me show you sort of a picture. Here is something that's called a Brill wave. It's essentially an axisymmetric vacuum spacetime asymptotically flat. And here is the time-time component of the metric. So you start things out, you know, you have things fairly strongly gravitating. After a while, they slosh around, and everything goes off the grid, and you're left with sort of flat space again. And this is, you know, using harmonic coordinates and you know, some very simple outgoing wave boundary condition. So as far as the outer boundary goes, this sort of thing is nice and stable. This is about a third of the amplitude for the Brill wave of what you would need to form a black hole. If I crank up the amplitude to maybe about half of what you need to form a black hole, then the coordinates go bad. And then I have to fiddle with source terms to sort of make things get back again. So that also is work in progress. Okay, so let me now conclude. So the basic conclusion of this is that, you know, we've sort of known for decades that harmonic coordinates are good mathematically. It seems that they're also promising as a numerical method. So as I said, this is sort of work in progress. And so things to do in the future are to look at how singularities behave in the more complicated vacuum case. And then to see what other things this numerical method can be used for. So in particular, it seems to work well up to this question of how do you do the source terms for gravitational waves. Another thing that you might think it might work well for is something called excision. It turns out for various reasons that people who do simulations of colliding black holes like to cut out the stuff inside the black hole horizon. And that's hard to do in a stable numerical way. But in this case, because we're just using something that's the wave operator, the light cones of the system are the same as the physical light cones. And so you might think that excision would work better with this as well. So roughly speaking, the sort of future projects to be done are examine the singularity in the vacuum case and then see whether the sorts of things that people are having trouble with in colliding black holes can be done better using this method. So that's basically the end of the talk. Thank you. Questions? Yeah, Gary?
Yeah, so I guess I have a question about how close to the singularity do you have to start your numerical evolution? I mean, you're saying that the harmonic coordinates work fine, must mean that you start pretty close, right? Because those are actually, if you fall away from the singularity, they're going to break down eventually. So.
Why is that?
I mean, typically, you can't cover the space. Well, I thought typically, one coordinate, harmonic coordinates don't work globally.
Let's take this on say the linearized level. Okay, suppose that I was going to examine the evolution of say weak gravitational waves in an asymptotically flat background. Okay, you want to think of the harmonic coordinates as being the usual Cartesian coordinates plus four little solutions of the wave equation. Well, since those are little solutions of the wave equation, they behave very nicely everywhere, because they're sort of small, their gradients are small compared to grad t, grad x, grad y, and grad z. So for weak gravity waves, you certainly expect there to be a global harmonic coordinate patch that covers the whole spacetime. What about the singularity? Well, in the Gaudi case, these coordinates, t, x, y, and z, it turns out are harmonic. So let me put that metric back for a second. Okay, so here, these coordinates definitely are harmonic. You can show, if you sort of write down the wave operator in this space-time, that t, x, y, and z are all solutions of the wave equation. So if, for example, the approach to the singularity is, nearly Gaudi, then you might expect that harmonic coordinates are globally good there as well. The other thing that you might expect, although it's not clear one way or the other, is that at a singularity, solutions of the wave equation might blow up in a particular way. And so this use of a time coordinate this use of a harmonic coordinate as your time coordinate is something that might automatically give you a coordinate that goes to infinity as the singularity is approached. So there's no sort of guarantee in any of this, but there's no guarantee that the coordinates will go bad or are likely to go bad either. And so empirically, what we found is that in the approach to the singularity, the harmonic coordinates seem to do fine. And in the asymptotically flat case, they do fine until gravity becomes strong, and then we need to do something else. Jim?
Well, I don't completely understand your last remark about the connection with Lax calculations. I mean, there are people colliding two black holes.
Mm-hmm.
They're interested in staying as away from the singularity as possible by all methods, right? By choosing space-like surfaces to avoid the singularity.
Sure.
It's in trouble one way.
Right.
By sizing inside the apparent horizon.
Right.
Right. For some unknown reason, at least some numerical instabilities. But your case is the harmonic coordinates are good for approaching the singularity. So why should they take your advice to use harmonic coordinates, for example, in their calculation of their doesn't try to stay as far away as possible?
Yeah, okay. So that's a good question. So let me actually draw on the blackboard to answer that. Can I get some lights?
Could you mind answering me? Could you say what the harmonic coordinates are in this
region? So I think I can
maybe was, and then explain why the sky is
really scattering. That one I actually know the answer to. Okay, so for Schwarzschild, the time coordinate is certainly a harmonic coordinate. You can easily show that this is the case. But that's not necessarily the one that you want to use, because that one goes singular on the horizon. So the idea is you want to sort of cleverly add to that some spherically symmetric solution of the wave equation such that the combination is nice on the horizon. And there is such a combination, but I forget exactly what it is.
Yeah, you're right near the singularity. You're right near the, you're just developing like from R equals 0.02.
Oh, you want to know what the harmonic coordinates in near the singularity in Schwarzschild are. Okay, so that or just in general. Let me answer the other question first about, you know, why should any numerical relativist take this advice? Because they want to stay far away from singularities, and these things seem to snuggle up to singularities. So here's the idea. Let's start with a picture of Schwarzschild. Well, okay, so. So let's suppose that we have, you know, say, some initial data surface that looks like this. And let's not worry about sort of this half of the diagram. So we have some slice. And now we want to know how we're supposed to evolve it. So in the early days of numerical relativity, people said, if we just go ahead and evolve these things, say, by, you know, pushing up by a certain amount of proper time, then after a very small amount of proper time, the slice is going to hit the singularity, and the code is going to crash, and so we had better not do that. There the notion then was, well, why don't we just make a bunch of slices that just sort of evolve in a nice way outside the horizon and inside the horizon, do something to stay far away from the singularity. So then we would get a family of slices that sort of look like this. Okay? And maybe they would sort of asymptote to some slice here inside the horizon, whereas outside they do something else. This seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to do, and for decades, you know, or maybe only, you know, one decade, people advocated things like maximal slicing, which do in fact have this property. So one, you know, sort of way of construing your question is to say, well, you know, look, maximal slicing gets nowhere near the singularity, harmonic slicing, you know, approaches the singularity at late times. It sounds like harmonic slicing is worse than maximal slicing. You know, people would have to be crazy to adopt it in numerical relativity.
Right, so
that's exactly the point. So the point is that even though on this diagram maximal slices look nice, in fact what maximal slices do is they become almost null here. So maybe I should draw one of these sort of old-fashioned diagrams where, you know, the horizon sort of looks like this and the singularity looks like that. So your initial slice sort of looks like this, but then in order to avoid the singularity, you have slices that sort of look like this. Okay? So in this diagram, it's a lot clearer that the price you pay for avoiding the singularity is that your slice gets stretched. While this stretched slice has a perfectly nice geometry, it turns out that because the slice is going almost null, what that means is that it lacks the spatial resolution to see what's going on. And so people quickly figured out that, in fact, maximal slicing is not a cure for everything either, because they just don't have the resolution to see what's going on in these stretched slices. So the answer for this that people are now looking at is something called excision. And the idea behind excision is the following. Let's not take this whole slice. Let's cut this slice off somewhere here. So at first sight, that might seem like a disaster. Anytime you cut a slice off, you have to do something at the edge of the slice. What are you supposed to do? And the answer to that is, who cares what you do? If you cut the slice off inside the black hole, then whatever you do cannot propagate outside the black hole, and so do anything you want. And pay attention only to stuff outside the horizon, and that's fine. So this is what people try to do now. And it's not completely successful for the following reason. It's true that nothing physical can propagate outside the black hole, but in fact, the numerics contain not only the physics, but all sorts of extraneous stuff, choices of laps and shift, choices of coordinates, this, that, and the other thing. That stuff can, in principle, come out of the black hole. In fact, all sorts of nasty things can and do happen when people try to implement this numerically. So my point about what's better about harmonic coordinates is that if you decide to excise, then since what you're evolving is essentially the wave equation, and since the null cones of the wave equation are the same as the null cones of the physical spacetime, you might expect a numerical implementation of excision in harmonic coordinates to work better than a numerical implementation of excision, say, using the ADM system. So that's essentially the idea. In this, you know, asymptotically flat case, nobody wants to get close to the singularity, but even with these so-called singularity-avoiding slices, they find they have to excise. And the point I'm making is that excision is not an easy thing to do numerically, and that it might work a lot better using harmonic coordinates than using what people are doing now.
Thanks. Strike the sky is blue question I'll ask
you. Okay. Okay. Any other questions? No? Okay. Thank you.